today on Against the Grain. Does the focus on mass imprisonment and racist cops have any drawbacks? According to Tony Platt, the carceral state extends far beyond prisons and police departments. I'm CS. I'll talk with the UC Berkeley-based scholar about his new book, Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Plenty of ink has been spilled about the crises of crime and punishment in the U.S. Far too many people are sent to prison. Cops abuse and kill innocent people. Solitary confinement breaks minds and spirits. The list goes on. But what if all the discussion and analysis on the left lacks something? Lacks what we need to grasp the full dimensions of the problems we face and the solutions adequate to those problems. Tony Platt shares what he thinks people need to understand about the carceral state, both today and historically, in his new book, Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. Tony Platt has written widely about issues of criminal justice, race, and inequality. He's a distinguished affiliate scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at UC Berkeley. When Tony joined me recently in studio, I asked what motivated him to write Beyond These Walls.
Well, I started thinking about the issues in this book in the 1970s, when there was a very strong and wide grassroots movement and activist movement to try to do something about policing and prisons. And we made some progress, and then we lost a lot of ground for many decades. And I start really writing about these issues because it became too pressing just to talk about how awful things were. But during the Obama years, when we saw a revival for the first time in a long time of a wide variety of activist movements around issues that concern me in the book, I felt this might be a good time to try to unite with those movements, but also provide an analysis and a depth and a history that would strengthen that movement in terms of what we're up against.
Was it your sense that some of the discussions around incarceration today are not informed by history and historical context?
Well, I think the United States in general does a really poor job of public history. California does a terrible job of public history. We wouldn't even know unless you had direct information that a genocide took place in this state. By going around the state, you wouldn't find any signs of that. So public history does a very poor job of that. But in addition to that, the left and progressive movements have never had any political power in Washington, D.C. and in the federal government that's lasted over many decades. This is probably the only country in the West that doesn't have a serious alternative oppositional labor or socialist party that's been in power for a long time. And so we don't have that repository of information and knowledge that gets passed on. And we have a tendency then to either not look back or to look back rather shallowly. So when I started this project, I started thinking about what would be the lessons of history and the lessons of struggles in the past that might be useful to activists today.
What do you think of claims made by many on the left that the current U.S. prison system is historically unprecedented?
Well, I think there's a lot of hyperbole in the left. This has been one of our problems, that we have the most racist system ever today. And the book argues that racism is alive and longstanding, going back into the 19th century with respect to prisons and policing. As for whether or not we incarcerate more people per capita than anywhere else in the world, I've looked at the evidence for that, and I think we don't know. I would think that we're very close to China. I think we're probably very close to Russia. I worry about claims that are really not verified. But still, to be up there in the world with an authoritarian state like China that incarcerates and segregates hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, I think we're on a par with that, but I don't think we need to then say that we're number one incarceration.
Now, give us some numbers. So how many people are in prison in the U.S. on any given day? And how many people in the U.S. have been incarcerated at least once in their lives?
Well, in terms of a daily basis, there's about 2.2 to 2.3 million people who are incarcerated every day. Now, that includes county and city jails, state prisons, federal prisons, prisons on Indian territory, and so on. That's a massive amount. I don't know the exact numbers of people that have been incarcerated in some time in the past, but it comes into millions, millions of people that have a felony record or a prison record that carry that around with them for the rest of their lives, almost like a social or civil death that limits their participation. So it's an enormous number of people.
It's an enormous number of people, and that's led a lot of people to use the word mass incarceration to describe one aspect of the problem, a major aspect of the problem. What do you think of that term?
Well, I think that term was created to identify a extraordinary shift that took place from the 70s to, say, the last 20 years, where there was an increase not just in the numbers of people incarcerated, but also the rate of incarceration for different populations, particularly African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, poor and working people. And so the term became one of those political terms to describe that. I think it's a useful term because when people use that term, they think politically of a large number of people being incarcerated. They think of us being at odds with the rest of the Western world. They think this is something that needs to be changed and dealt with. So as a political term, I think it's useful. I think what's problematic about it sometimes is that, one, it limits the argument to only prisons and jails. And doesn't look at other forms of what I would call carceral institutions that go far beyond prisons and jails. And secondly, it doesn't have a deep history. So to suggest that mass incarceration is more racist than ever in the past, I don't agree with that. And one of the things I do in the book is to try to make the case that racism has been a central feature of incarceration going back to the defeat of Reconstruction in the middle of the 19th century.
Give us a couple historical examples of race and incarceration in the past, in the U.S. past, that would inform our understanding of how unprecedented or historically repetitive our situation is today.
Well, if you look at the long history of African Americans in this country, they've always been targeted by police and by incarceration. And most people trace that, first of all, to slavery, but then after slavery, after the defeat of Reconstruction and the way in which the South used imprisoned labor, particularly black labor, as a way to force the economic resurrection of the South. And they played a critical role in that. But it's a wider racial and class issue than African Americans. African Americans are central to this story and this narrative. But for example, at about the same time in the middle of the 19th century in California, you didn't have black codes here, but you really had red or native codes. You had Native Americans who'd survived genocide being picked up for exactly the same non-crimes as free black people in the South were being picked up on the other coast, and then forced into the labor market, forced into work in sort of a semi-slavery status. You also have, in the 1880s, for example, in California, you have the Chinese being driven out of rural communities, being criminalized, being driven into the Chinatowns on the West Coast, and then ending up in institutions for crimes associated with who they were, not so much of what they have done. So, for example, if you'd walked into San Quentin Prison in the 1880s and looked around, you'd have seen immediately that there was a preponderance of Chinese immigrants in that prison, in the same way that if you walked in today, you would be struck by the number of African Americans in the prison system. Or another example would be in California and elsewhere in the West, the use of boarding schools that were used against young people from Native American communities and tribes. They were forcibly taken away from their families and put into boarding schools with a view of being assimilated and acculturated and being told that they couldn't practice their religious or ceremonial behaviors and practices, that they were forced to wear Western clothing, practice Christianity, and so on. So there's many examples of that, and there's also a lot of non-racial examples. So in the 19th century, late 19th century on the East Coast, if you'd gone into the penitentiaries there, you'd have seen a hyperponderance of the sons of immigrants or immigrants themselves who made up a high percentage of the people in the state prisons, working in the factories in the prisons. And they were primarily European immigrants compared to California, where you have Mexican and Chinese forming a large part of the 19th century prison population. So I argue that the prison system, but also the wider carceral system, is extraordinarily promiscuous and flexible and has operated in a systematic way over a long period of time.
So if people, when they think about the carceral state, they think about prisons and jails, corrections departments, prison guards, if that doesn't fill out adequately or even close to adequately your understanding of punishment in the U.S. today, who are some of the other players, the players in the carceral state that we don't tend to think about?
Well, I use the term carceral following a really important decision that dissent that Sonia Sotomayor made on the Supreme Court about a case in which she thought the police had misused their authority to stop people on the street and arrest them without evidence. And she said that we live in a carceral state that regulates, controls, identifies whole populations, and treats people as though they're less than full citizens or less than full members of our society. So when you look at that term and then try to go beyond the prisons and the urban police and the county jails and so on, I would include the welfare system, which at least since the Clinton administration treats people as though they're either criminal or potentially criminal and humiliates and regulates people, mostly women and their children, seeking a decent life. If you look at policing, it's important to look also not just at public cops that tend to be in the limelight these days because they're at the forefront of repressive operations, particularly in poor communities. But private policing, there's many more private cops than there are public cops. They do a lot of the same things that public cops do. They do a lot of things in conjunction with regular cops and work together. And I think if we're concerned about policing and policing being out of control, you have to look at the large number of private security operations that also are there. Then I would look more broadly, for example, at school disciplinary procedures, where a lot of the initial contacts are made between a public agency and kids who end up in trouble and get marked and identified and start their way down that pipeline to being identified as trouble and problem and criminal. And also here in the Bay Area, the so-called civility codes, the way in which public health authorities and social workers and police combine together to sweep out encampments, to cite people, to tell people where they can sit and not sit and so on, largely outside of the criminal justice system. Some people do occasionally get arrested for that behavior, but you're talking here about a whole set of operations that really happens in conjunction with the criminal justice system and outside of it. So, or another very important example would be the whole immigration process. And we tend to think of the immigration process as being separate from what happens in criminal justice, but millions of people get caught up in what is a civil process, but they get treated as though they're criminals. They get deported. They get railroaded without any due process. Millions of people get either put in institutions or sent across the border to Mexico and Central America or turned around at the border after being put in detention and so on. So the carceral state, as I said, is a pretty wide-scale operation, and police and prisons play an important part of them, but they're not the only part.
That's Tony Platt. He's a distinguished affiliate scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at UC Berkeley, and we're talking about his new book, Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Yeah, I'm reading from your book on the issue of private cops. You write that as of 2010, security workers, and I think these are private security workers, outnumber public police by more than 25%, and companies that provide personnel and make security-related products are the recipients of government contracts that far exceed the amount of public money spent on criminal justice operations nationally. So this is indeed a huge area, a huge arena in which punishment is meted out in the U.S. what needs to be said about the, you know, how democratic private security operations are and how accountable they are to the public?
Well, private security stands outside of government regulation. It's almost impossible to get actually information from government agencies about how many private security operations there are in the United States, how they operate, what they get paid, and so on. There's very little information that's collected. It was hard to get that information. And there's no accountability to any political institutions. So they operate as sort of a classic agency in the neoliberal state as a private operation that gets brought in for security and which produces large profits for the people that run these agencies, much more than, say, the money that's made out of private prisons or the exploitation of prisoners, which is really a very small part of it. But at the same time, I don't want to give the impression that the regular police, so-called public police, are themselves any more democratic or accountable. Public policing, I argue, has always been undemocratic. It's always been combative. It's always been militarized. It's always been unaccountable to the communities in which they work. This was set up in the late 19th and early 20th century when the police first became professionalized. And the early models for American policing came from organizations like the National Guard and the militia and the private security agencies, which in the 19th century, which were really the first police departments, organizations like Pinkertons and Burns. So they were the model for what followed in terms of urban professional policing and sheriff's departments and so on. And that started from the beginning in a militarized way. I know today we think of policing as being highly militarized. And sometimes we think about the way in which wartime surplus, for example, from Iraq is being used by police departments. And that's true. They've become more militarized in the last 10 or 20 years. There's no question about that. But that has deep roots. And if you go back and read accounts of policing around the labor movement or the early part of the 20th century, you see the same imagery of the police describing themselves as being at war, as being in combat, as being what Teddy Roosevelt, when he was the head of policing in New York before he became president, described the police as a semi-military. That was always there right from the beginning. So I don't think we should have illusions that police militarization is a recent problem.
Tell us more about private policing in the 19th century and how integral it was to maintaining, quote, law and order in this country and, you know, what kinds of levels of force and violence were perpetrated by not professional public police as we understand today, but by Pinkertons and the like?
Well, the first organized policing in the United States, in the South, it has a lot to do. It comes out of slave patrols and controlling African-American populations, free and unfree. It has that history and that tradition there. And that's what gives us later on, for example, organizations like the Texas Rangers that are highly combative and racist in terms of their organization and their ideology. But elsewhere, particularly on the East Coast and the Midwest, private policing, as it developed, really as an adjunct of big business, of agriculture, of industry, and was particularly designed to try to curb and stop the labor movement. That was its primary operation. Major companies had huge security forces well into the 20th century, some of them bigger than many police departments around the country. And so they were called in to regulate strikes, to spy on workers. There was a big surveillance operation, and many police were planted into labor organizations and either set up people in labor organizations or got them arrested. And then when it came to strikes and militant organizing by the labor movement, private security would come in and it would be a battle. And the labor movement saw it as us versus them. It wasn't like some of the debates today. How can we make the police more accountable or more serve the community? Both sides saw themselves in a battle, and thousands of people were killed, people were badly injured, people were arrested, and so on. And that became a very big influence on the early days of what then becomes professional policing.
Were the big companies, the employers who wanted to impose their will on large numbers of workers, were they tempted at all to go to the actual police, the public police that existed in their town or cities, to try and subdue their workers? I mean, was that an option for them?
It wasn't a very good option because the police in the early 20th century were poorly trained and quite amateurish. But the bigger problem for companies that wanted to use police as strike breakers and to go after workers is that many members of police forces, urban police forces, came from the same communities as the strikers and the workers and had a strong identification with them. So part of the early development of professional policing was to try to create a wedge between cops and communities, which was very successfully done. That's why in the early days of the labor movement, the National Guard and the militia were used because they were forces that weren't local. They were being organized and recruited and brought in from other towns and other places. They didn't have cousins and brothers and sisters and parents who were in the labor movement. And often when police departments began to be organized in the cities, the recruiters would ask people questions about their views about the labor movement and did they have relatives that were in the labor movement and were organizers and so on. So that professionalization of policing doesn't happen overnight. It takes a couple of decades for that to happen. But part of what professionalization means is creating police forces that have no identification with the communities in which they work, that they can be dispassionate, they can be cruel, they can think of those communities as being less than human or as an other or as racially different and racially troubled. So that's built into the early days of policing, and we see the consequences of that 100 years later as police departments can come in and treat whole communities as though they're not part of humanity.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Tony Platt, he is the author of numerous books examining issues of criminal justice, race, inequality, and social justice in the U.S. and in U.S. history. And we are talking about his new book. It's called Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Tony, criminal justice is typically framed as a local and a state issue. Do you agree with that?
I don't. And I think our movement of trying to make the police more accountable, the police in particular, and to create policing that is either drastically reduced or humanized and transformed, I think there's a problem if we only see it at the local level. And it's understandable why a lot of actions around police take place at the local level, because the local police are the ones that are there. They're taking on the battles. They're the ones that we see in the street. They're the ones that are armed. They're the ones that are choking people to death and killing people at a rate of about 3 a day. So it's understandable why we try to do organizing around policing at a local level. But I think it's important, and I try to make the case in the book, that policing at the local level gets its ideas from a much wider set of issues and frameworks. So I'll give you two examples. One is I think U.S. foreign policy has had a lot to do with domestic American policing. That if you go back, for example, to the first imperial war that the United States engaged in, which would be in the Philippines in the 1900s, the process there involved rounding up people who were seen as political opposition, who were seen as dangerous to American hegemony in the region after the defeat of Spain. And people were rounded up in the thousands and put in special institutions, were tortured. This is where waterboarding, as we know it today, first started. But also the agencies that were there developed attitudes about the Filipino population as being sort of subhuman and dangerous and potentially a problem for civilization. And when people then came back, when high-level officials came back, they brought that back and brought back those ideas. We might call it the boomerang effect. So somebody, for example, like August Vollmer from Berkeley here, he was the first police chief in Berkeley. He was the one that got University of California at Berkeley to start criminology studies. And he was a leader of the national professionalization of police movement in the first half of the 20th century. So he was based in the Philippines, and that's where he developed the views of policing as being a military operation, of being a combative operation, and that police had to go against communities as though they were the enemy. So there's a long tradition of that, all the way up to, for example, the fact that today Baltimore uses technology on the streets and surveillance systems that were developed in Iraq. So that's one influence, and I think it's had a pretty deep influence because it comes back to the federal government. And then the federal government has a huge impact on local police forces because they supervise the training, the ideology. They often send the weapons systems and the ideology to local police forces. I think local police forces get their messages from a national institutions, national government, about who needs to be on the dangerousness watch, which populations are problematic. So, for example, J. Edgar Hoover, who had a long role to play at the FBI from very early in the 20th century, after World War I, for example, he was writing public statements where he said that African Americans who came back from the war were too uppity, were trying to get rights too quickly, that they didn't have a right to citizenship, that they were organizing, or they were being led by communists and so on. I mean, he had those views very early on, and then I think that ideology spread to the local level where local police departments then looked out for uppity African Americans and black political organizations that were dangerous and so on. And that would go all through the 60s and 70s. So, for example, we know from the media papers that were liberated in the early 1970s that, for example, the FBI had agents at places like Swarthmore College, where an agent there proudly reported to Hoover that every single African-American student there was under watch and surveillance for potential subversion or dangerousness. So I think, it's a hard enough battle to take on illegal and undemocratic policing at the local level, but it also has to be understood that this is a national battle as well.
Another point you make in this book is that, well, you draw parallels between prisons and ghettos and reservations. What are the contours of that argument?
Well, I think if we think about carceral measures, that is, measures that are taken to regulate, identify, control, punish populations on the basis of who they are, not so much on the basis of what they've done, then I think we need a wide view of how that operates. And I think I'm not making the argument that reservations and boarding schools are exactly the same as, say, a local jail or a state prison, but I think they're cousins. I think they come out of a larger framework of trying to figure out different kinds of institutions that will regulate populations that are seen as problematic. And I think it's important to do this because then we understand that the problem of the carceral state is not just prisons and jails. They are a central part of this, but there's a much wider process going on. And so, for example, one of the things I do in the book is try to reintegrate what is usually a separate history, that is Native American history, particularly the reservation and the boarding school, is not usually talked about or discussed or written about in the context of prisons and policing and so on. But here I try to make the argument that we need to integrate that history into not just our analytical understanding of how these things work, but also our political understanding of the necessity for unities and coalitions between different kinds of populations.
His name is Tony Platt, P-L-A-T-T, Distinguished Affiliate Scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at UC Berkeley, and his new book is Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. We'll take a short break and speak more with Tony about his really interesting book. Please stay with us.
Thank you.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Tony Platt joins me. His new book is Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. So the Obama years were cited, you know, at the time as well as today, as a point in time when reforms were at least discussed and debated, reforms to the so-called criminal justice system. How would you assess the reforms proposed during those years and the reforms implemented during those years in terms of whether you saw any significant changes to the system, to the carceral state being enacted?
I think it was a lot of hope, particularly among people who had read Obama's autobiography before he became president, because he has powerful insights into how criminal justice works, how young people get selected and identified at a very early age and get segregated and punished for who they are, not for what they did. There's a lot of very revealing insights in that book, and we've never had a president that had that kind of smart assessment of how things work and how racism operates and so on. But the Obama administration, I don't think, took the initiative around so-called reform of criminal justice. I think it was forced to take action. I think during his years, partly because of the political cultural space given by having Obama in the White House and by having some Democrats who were talking about the need for reform, that movements on the ground started being very, very active. I mean, you know, for example, we've had killings by the police 3 a day forever. I mean, we have good records on that. We have information of that. If you go back and read James Baldwin in the 1960s, he's talking about the same problem. If you go back to the labor movement in the 20s and 30s, they're talking about the same issue. So police killings in the Obama decade was not anything new, but what was new was the fierce level of organizing that took place on the streets. Also, we had a revival of the Me Too movement and a new wave of feminism where people were going to demand that the struggles of the past were not over and that feminism was not a dead issue. We also had anti-immigration struggles that took place all over the country for many years, people marching and protesting against immigration laws that were cruel and unjust and inhumane. So there was a tremendous amount of activism, and I think that activism pushed the Obama administration, or if you want to look at it more favorably, made it possible for the Obama administration to respond and to create a political cultural space for debates. So during that time, you see a revival of liberal democratic, social democratic ideas about prison reform. You see the Obama administration setting up task forces and local cities setting up task forces to talk about what are the problems with policing and how can we make them more democratic, more legitimate, more responsive to communities and so on.
Well, a lot of these reform initiatives tend to target cops on the beat and prison guards and people like that, trying to get them to change their behavior and their attitudes. Is that the right focus in your mind?
No, you're absolutely right, because I think the reforms that came out of the Obama administration at the top level, they were very concerned with issues of legitimacy, that is, trying to make the police be seen as a legitimate force in the communities in which they worked. And so if they were too brutal, if they were killing people, if they weren't civil, if they weren't responsive, that aggravated tensions and politics in those communities. And from the viewpoint of the Obama administration, they had in mind retraining cops, making the police aware of their unconscious racism, having them wear cameras on their uniforms, having them go through multicultural training and so on. And that wasn't new. You can find examples of that going back to the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration. I mean, this has been tried forever. And I think James Baldwin had it right when he said, you know, you can't have people police a ghetto in a nice, humane way. And in a way, I felt and still feel sympathetic to cops who say, on the one hand, you want us to guard these communities, go after these communities, go in full military combat, see these communities as dangerous, as hotbeds of criminality, and so on. And then on the other hand, you want us to be nice and civil and treat people well. I mean, what do you want us to do? So the cops at the ground level, I think, were the recipients of those kinds of reforms that were, as I argue, really ineffective in changing police practices. And the prison reform movement, I think, was similarly ineffective at the national level. There were some really important efforts coming from not just activists, but also from nonprofit organizations and from liberal Democrats trying to drastically cut the prison population nationally. But that was blocked in Congress. Republicans didn't want anything of any kind of serious reform of the prison system. So nothing happened there. And then on the other hand, you have the increased criminalization of immigrants that was going on under Obama. And admittedly, he was trying to make a deal, the deal being that, you know, get a path to citizenship for the 800,000 people who came as children with their parents undocumented, and in exchange for that, crack down on the border, arrest people, detain people, deport people. And so in the Obama years, while he was fighting for that deal, more people were incarcerated and deported than every other president combined, not just every previous president, but every single president combined. It was a very brutal and repressive system. And then he lost on the Dreamers. So we end up, when Trump comes in, we end up with a anti-immigration system that's profoundly repressive. So the Obama years, I think, are very mixed. On the one hand, it's a time of political debate and political room for a progressive discourse to take place. And liberals who'd been cut out of the system for a long time, academics and NGOs that had been not listened to for years, were back at the table and felt like they had a place to be heard during the Obama years. But I don't think any kind of structural changes were made.
And as far as the structure itself, the existing structure, the existing context, I think a lot of people see it as monolithic, as having a certain unity of purpose, seeing it as a kind of a hyper-organized system behind a certain agenda. Do you see it that way?
I see it as a lot more chaotic than that. If you want to use a literary parallel, I think of Kafka more than Orwell. I think, particularly in the Trump years, the carceral system has become more repressive, more determined, more vicious, and so on. But we're not talking about a unified system. There's extraordinary differences in policing and prisons in different states throughout the country. There's arguments and debates amongst criminal justice agencies. You see many federal judges in the last few years trying to put a brake on the worst of the immigration policies being instituted by the Trump administration. You know, there's lots of contradictions and oppositions and a lot of agencies that battle with one another. You know, at the national level, you have Homeland Security that is basically forcing a lot of local police departments to make counterterrorism a major part of what they do. But some police departments are fighting back against that. I think this is important because I think if you see it as a closed system or a unified system, or start using the word fascism too loosely, then basically I think we're giving too much power and coherence to the current situation. I see it as being extraordinarily dangerous and authoritarian, but also quite disorderly.
Tony Platt joins me in studio, distinguished affiliate scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at UC Berkeley. His new book is Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we are really, I mean, we're talking about a lot of things, but we're really scratching the surface of this book. Right, and kind of understanding the fissures in the system, the fragmented nature, to some degree, of the carceral state is important for people who want to push back against the system. And people have been pushing back for decades and for centuries. One chapter in your book, in fact, looks at the opposition and resistance and creative energy waged against the carceral state historically. So let's talk about some facets of this kind of opposition. You point to, for example, the prison memoir as a form of opposition to the criminal justice or criminal punishment system. How important has that genre been?
That genre has been very important. You can go back to the late 19th century to find a work, for example, a memoir by Austin Reed, an African-American convict who wrote one of the earliest prison memoirs. That book has actually been republished and with a new introduction that came out a few years ago. And you go all the way from that through Malcolm X's famous autobiography that was read by millions of people, the writings of George Jackson, the work of Piri Thomas, a local author and former prisoner who wrote a stunning book about his time in prison, Down These Mean Streets, and he also wrote a prison memoir as well. It's very much a part not just of prison literature, but according to Bruce Franklin, who's written a lot about the history of literature in the United States, he makes the case that the prison memoir and fiction and poetry and writing is a very important part of the American literary experience in general, not just the prison experience.
You write that of all the leftists who were imprisoned in the U.S. before World War II, Eugene Debs was among the most thoughtful and most engaged by his experience. What did he learn while behind bars, and what did he write about the experience, and what ought to be done with prisons?
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile going back and reading Debs. I mean, he's an important political labor leader. I mean, he was the head of the Socialist Party. He came out of the labor movement. He was in jail and prison many times for labor organizing, for union organizing, for disorderly behavior at demonstrations, for speaking out against U.S. entry into World War I, which could get you time, and it got his time. And so he did time in federal penitentiary, in the state penitentiary, in local jails. He had a lot of deep knowledge about that. And whenever a political organizer or a political activist goes to prison, they organize where they are. So Debs was very, very active, and I think it's worth going back to read his materials and to learn from him. I get the title of my book, Beyond These Walls, from a maxim that he said, you know, beyond these walls, sweet freedom calls. He was always interested in the potentiality for progressive movements to both come out of the prison and also transform it. And from my perspective, there are a few important things that I'd learned from him. One is that he made a very, very strong case that people who do time, we're now talking about the 1920s, 1910s, 1920s, that they're like everybody else. They're like you and me. And he made the case that the prison system tries to create the narrative that people who do time are a sort of a different species of humanity. And he was always for getting people to recognize that common humanity of people inside and outside, or to think there but for the grace of God, go I or go you. And I don't think we see that again until maybe the 50s and 60s in the civil rights movement, where the prison and the jail became an outpost of the civil rights struggle, and we got a very humanized view of people that were doing time then. So he was very, very good on that. But secondly, he was also, as it turned out, it was a surprise to me, he was probably the earliest example of an abolitionist. So in his writings, he talks about the need to abolish the prison, that you can't have a humane prison. It's a contradiction in terms, and that the prison is sort of a relic of the barbaric past, and that people get worse inside the institutions, not better, and that we need to get rid of it, that it's a particularly repressive and cruel and class and race-based institution. So that was important to find, you know, that tradition of abolitionism goes back to the 1920s. But he was also a very practical person. He was a very practical organizer. He had a lot of experience organizing. So he said, you know, until the day that we get rid of prisons or abolish them, we also need to talk about reforms. And he came up with some very substantial ideas about reform. For example, he wanted to turn over a lot of the governance of prisons to prisoners themselves. He thought you needed some people with high levels of technical, specialized information and knowledge, like doctors and other people that had expertise and so on. But he thought that most of what happens in the prison should be run by the prisons. He saw it as a potentially sort of a democratically run institution. And when he got out of prison, he said, I have a lot of ideas. I've thought about these things. I've written about them. I offer my services for free to prison authorities to help do some of these things. And nobody took him up on that. The other reason I think why Debs and that whole cohort of the 1920s and 30s and 40s, right throughout the 20th century, it's important to look at them because they tried very hard to do a lot of the same things that we're trying to do today. Not only did they have good ideas, but they also eventually got defeated. And I think that tells us something about the political, economic, cultural importance of the carceral state, why these institutions are so central to the way in which power is exercised in this country, that if they weren't so central and so important, then I think we'd have an easier time changing them.
Is it right to say that marginalized people, targeted populations in this country, racialized populations in this country are discarded, or is there something else going on? Are they reserved by the system for some other use, or put to some other use by the system?
I think here I need to put on my historian hat and say that I think you really have to look at it in context and specific eras. I think how these institutions are run, what they're set out to do, the populations that get caught in them varies enormously from time to time. I mean, for example, in the late 19th century, prisons were really run as factories and industrial operations. San Quentin, for example, in the 1880s had probably the largest factory in the whole of California. It ran three shifts. They made jute bags for the weed industry until the whole factory got burned down. But that was typical all over the country. The prison was really like a manufactory. Whereas today you go into most prisons and there's almost no productive prison labor. The only labor that prisoners really work on is to maintain the institutions that they're in. Private operations don't really run in prisons. Private prisons are really a very small part of the prison operation as well. And that the function of prisons today, I think, is very, very different. I think today it has much more of a political, social, cultural function of warehousing, controlling, regulating huge populations of people that are marginal to the economy, and also serving as a warning to people that have jobs they don't like, or part-time jobs, or difficult jobs, a warning to them that there's a fate worse than poverty that awaits them.
A lot of people point to the Attica Rebellion, the rebellion at the Attica Correctional Facility in Attica, New York, in 1971 as one of the key signposts in terms of rebellions, prison protests. How do we understand that historically? Are there precedents to Attica and other similar uprisings in, say, the 60s and 70s that you want to point to in this book?
Attica is very important, but again, I think a historical journey is important too. So, for example, you could go back to the second half of the 19th century and find that prisoners often operated like a labor force, going on strike, demanding better working conditions, better food, better medical care, more time off from work and so on. A lot of the same issues that were a part of the prison movement a century later. So there's a long history of that. And also in the same way that in the 70s, prison authorities began to single out and isolate the activist organizers and move them off to special prisons and supermaxes and solitary confinement and so on. This also happened in the 19th century, where the prison authorities went after the labor organizers in the prison. So there's precedent to this. And it's true that the prison struggles of the late 60s and early 70s were politically and culturally of extraordinary importance. But also, following World War II, if you go back to the 50s and early 60s, as I do in the book, there are many precedents to what happens at Attica, in the same way that, the story of Rosa Parks, the narrative often gets reduced to the fact that she was the first one to sort of sit down in the bus and refuse to go into her assigned seat and so on. But she and others have said that they've been trying to do that for years. That was a tactic of the civil rights movement. And so long before Attica, if you look at the demands made by the prisoners at Attica, they were very comparable to demands that came out of prison struggles in the 50s and 60s. There were a lot of them. The Attica struggle caught a political cultural moment. It gave energy to a political movement, and it got people to learn about issues they didn't know about. So it was extraordinarily important politically and culturally. And also it was a marker for administrations around the country that they needed to figure out ways to control prison rebellions. And so it's in that moment of Attica and that period that you get the rise of these ominous, special, authoritarian prisons, the places like Pelican Bay at Crescent City, these so-called supermaxes that emphasize segregation and humiliation and torture. They in large part came out of a response to the early 70s political rebellions and a way to try to get the most activist prisoners and to segregate them from other people.
So, Tony, you write in your book, Beyond These Walls, you write that progressive movements need to articulate a program of structural reforms. What, in your mind, should that program include?
Well, I think we shouldn't give up on big ideas. I mean, you know, I came of age and was an activist in a time when we thought we had big dreams about utopian societies, about socialism, about communism, about national liberation, about progressive social democratic societies. And I think we're in a period now where those movements have been defeated and we're in a long period of interregnum trying to figure out new directions, new utopias. But I think it's important to have utopias in mind. I think one of the successes of the Trump administration and previous right-wing political parties in the United States is that they're able to talk big about law and order, about the need to control people, the need for surveillance, the need to go after people who are disruptive and dangerous and anti-American and so on. They have very big ideas that guide the policies and that undergird the policies that they support. And I think the left and progressive activists that we need to be thinking in similar ways about what does abolitionism look like today? What would it mean to totally transform policing or to get rid of policing as we know it and to provide a very different kinds of police forces? And then also I think we need structural reforms. And by structural reforms, I have in mind reforms that like Debs talked about in the 1920s, that would make a significant difference in people's everyday lives, such as getting rid of cash bail, which puts something like 60% of the current population in jail, is there because they don't have money to get out while awaiting trial. To do drastic reduction of the prison population. Wasn't too long ago that we were talking about 50% cut in the prison population. I think we could do 70 or 80% cuts. I think we also need to talk about developing unities between different movements struggling around the carceral state. There's been too many divisions, for example, around struggles around deportations and the demonization of immigrants and the mass incarceration movement and the anti-police violence movement. I think if we could develop unities and coalitions between those movements, then not only could we have big ideas about our future, but I think also we could come up with reforms that in the short run would make a significant difference. And there's great power in these single-issue movements, but it's very hard to sustain protests on the street, for example, against police violence, or for prison reform, or for to stop deportations. But when those movements begin to coalesce and find unities, then I think we would have more political success.
Tony Platt, author of a number of books examining issues of criminal justice, race, inequality, and social justice, and the author most recently of Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States. He's a distinguished affiliate scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks, Tony, for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.